interrupt your regularly scheduled program for a special announcement. The United States is headed for an entitlement crisis. Social Security and Medicare are going broke. You are going to have to pay the bill.
You are going to have to pay the bill.
Welcome to the Debt Dialogues, where you'll learn about the coming entitlement crisis, how it affects you, and what you can do about it.
Debt Dialogues.
Here's your host, Ayn Rand Institute Fellow Don Watkins.
My guest today is Jared Meyer. Jared is a policy analyst at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and co-author of a new book, Disinherited: How Washington is Betraying America's Young. Jared, welcome to the Debt Dialogues.
Hey, thanks for having me, Don.
So the co-author, I should mention, of your book is Diana Ferschgott-Roth, who we've also had in this podcast. Why don't you just tell us first a little bit about what the book is addressing and why you decided to write it?
So the book looks at how government policy has a general tendency to favor established, older interests, and this comes at the expense of young Americans. So we see this going all the way across. This isn't something that just is confined to the debt or Obamacare or education. I mean, this is a wide-ranging problem that extends to far after people graduate high school or college. We're constantly seeing, you know, like I said, established interests being protected by government and government putting policies in place that really hold back opportunity for young Americans. And we think, you know, a lot of people talk about income inequality or climate change as the defining challenge of our time. I think when you look at how a country's treating its young people, that's really where the key challenge is how to overcome that.
So you cover a bunch of issues in the book, Social Security, healthcare. We've talked quite a bit about those on the podcast, but why just give us a few of the most important facts on those issues and the way in which they're affecting younger Americans.
Well, I mean, we had to put in a section on entitlement spending because the debt that we're passing on to the next generation and, you know, even, you know, that exists right now is really just unacceptable. And it's going to put a heavy burden on people who really never voted for these policies or never had a say in them to then pay them back. So if we're looking at, you know, everyone talks about $18 trillion in federal debt, but that's just the surface. When we take into account entitlement spending and what we promised versus where the funding levels are at, this so-called fiscal gap is over $200 trillion, and that's 12 times GDP and 16 times what you usually hear, you know, the $18 trillion mentioned. So this is a major problem. And to, you know, one thing they could do is cut benefits, which I don't, you know, see as very likely, at least not right now. But to do that, to pay off what we have right now, you would need a cut in 37% of all government spending. And that's ignoring, you know, what you would have to still pay on the interest. Or what you could do is just increase taxes by, you know, only 57%. So this is a major problem that's going to continue to burden generations into the future. I mean, we talked with a lot of millennials when writing the book, and what they told us is, you know, they're paying into Social Security, they're paying into Medicare, but they never really expect to receive even close to what they paid in back if the programs are even going to be there for them at all.
Yeah, that's definitely what I hear talking to young people. But the other thing is, it doesn't seem to be a particularly crusading issue for them. So you mentioned global warming or inequality. Those are issues, whatever your view of them, that seem to get young people excited, engaged. It really leads them to actually take action. And yet, when it comes to something like Social Security, Medicare, the broader issue of old age welfare state programs, there seems to be some sense among young people that, yeah, it's not very good for us, but they don't seem to be particularly inspired on those issues. And I'm wondering if A, you agree with that impression, and B, why you think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that when people are looking at the problems facing America, especially young people, while they tend to see Social Security as a problem and unfair to themselves, they just can't wrap their heads around like $200 trillion. I mean, I don't know what a stack of $200 trillion pennies would look like. Like, I don't think the human brain can even process something that big. So our debt's gotten so out of control that it's really unfathomable. But one thing I did notice, there was a recent poll that talked to millennials and asked them about, you know, their political priorities, where they lean on certain issues. And even though millennials tend to be, you know, socially liberal and support some parts of the welfare state, it was a really high percentage. Like I want to say around 70% of millennials thought that reforming Social Security was an important priority. So they do see that something needs to be done. And I guess they've kind of accepted that, you know, it's, they're going to be the losers in this program. So maybe that's why they're not pushing for it as much as it is. Like one millennial we talked to, he said, you know, he's grown up his whole life with a full acceptance of this giant national debt. I mean, maybe they just don't see it as a big issue because they've never known anything else.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is that like the debt's a consequence. And the question is the underlying thing that the government's doing seen as good and right? And I think part of what your book is drawing attention to is that if what's really happening is that young people are getting treated in such a way as they're not going to be able to achieve many of their hopes and dreams because of these programs, it should at least be a question of whether this transfer of wealth from younger people to older people is right. And that's something we should be thinking about rather than just taking for granted that it's right.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, everyone knows the current system's unsustainable. It's just, you know, I want my benefits that a lot of people view as earned. I mean, even in the book, I put in an interview I did with my grandfather. I remember him. He told me, he's like, well, I've worked my whole life for Social Security. You know, I've earned this. But what he didn't realize was politicians in Washington have been selling a false bill to older Americans and retirees by telling them, you know, this is what you've earned. They're hiding up that it's a, you know, tax and transfer system. It's pay as you go, but it's sold to people as an investment and something that they really earned. So it's not the other thing with the book is I don't, after, you know, studying this for a while, I don't see it as generational warfare. Like this wasn't intentional. Grandparents obviously want the best for their grandkids. It's more of just Washington continually making promises that they can't fulfill and then hiding behind the guise of things like public safety and workplace regulation so that then they can protect other people and keep young Americans out of the workforce.
So we've talked a lot about Social Security and healthcare on this program. You covered though a lot of other ground that we haven't delved into quite as much. So let's turn to the issue of education. Now, I think there's a general sense that education is in America is not exactly achieving its goals of educating. But talk a little bit about the state of education today and how that affects opportunity for young people.
I mean, America's hands down fallen behind its international competitors in educating its youngest members. I mean, if we're looking at the problem, though, a lot of people will say, well, we just need to spend more money. You know, the schools are underfunded. We can't get the proper equipment there, all these things. But that's not the main issue. If we look at school funding, it's increased like almost 250% over the last 50 years, adjusted for inflation. So we've been spending more money to try to correct the problem, and that hasn't worked. And what I see as the main issue is that a lot of teachers' unions, instead of working to protect students, they're trying to protect their members. And this comes not only to disadvantaged students, but a lot of young teachers. Like I had a few of my friends who studied education in school and went to become teachers. Like they're going to be the first ones who are laid off, despite it doesn't matter how good they are. Like when you're basing pay and hiring decisions on seniority rather than talent, you're drawing people away from teaching who, you know, couldn't be making a valuable contribution to students' lives in the future, and you're also keeping bad teachers in place. So I see a lot of the problems with America's education system is the undue influence of public sector teachers' unions.
So can you talk a little bit though more about, like, what is it the consequence of the unions that's undermining the quality of education today, and what's changed such that the unions are now more powerful than they were, say, 30 or 40 years ago, where presumably things weren't as bad?
Yeah, what we have right now is the growth in the increase in spending to education. It isn't even all just going to teachers. We've had a ton more administrators hired at schools, and money's going to things that really don't have anything to do with education. And I think teachers' unions have gotten more, I guess you want to call it, militant, in because they feel under pressure because of the success of things like charter schools or voucher programs. And as they've continued to fall behind private schools, I think instead of adapting and doing what's best for the kids, they kind of dug in their heels. They're like, we're not changing. We're going to fight for what we think's ours. And the rest of the world also has just gotten better in terms of education. It's not that the U.S. has gotten worse. It's just stagnated. And that's not acceptable in a, you know, global economy where, you know, other countries are then producing more educated children. And if we look at teachers in America now, a lot of people, you know, who maybe wanted to be a teacher before but saw how, and maybe were disgusted with what the teachers' unions are doing, decide they don't want to go into that profession. And a lot of teachers now, we have most teachers are coming from the bottom third of the college graduates. So we're not bringing in talented individuals who could then be, you know, incentivized with higher pay because of the structure that's in place currently.
Yeah, my own view is, well, first this question, do you know anything about the state of teachers' unions in other countries, especially the ones that have surpassed us?
One thing I do know is America's unique in that it's one of the few countries that has a practical monopoly on education. Even countries in Europe, you know, South America, they all have much higher percentages of private schools or charter schools or alternative schooling options. So America, even though we think about it, you know, there's a good amount of private schools, it's still one of the smallest in the world. So we've seen that it's become increasingly just public schools, and a lot of people, especially, you know, inner city students, don't really have another way to turn. So they're stuck with, you know, going to one school, even if that doesn't work the best for them or it's a failing school.
Well, that's part that really speaks to my own view on this, which is the great tragedy is not that, you know, we have lower test scores than these other countries. I mean, that makes I think the problem even worse. The bigger problem is that there is this government monopoly on schooling. Now, if you actually had a free market in education, there'd be all sorts of innovations we can't even dream of. But I mean, if you just think about some of the obvious choices that would be open to people if there wasn't this monopoly, it would be everything from what kind of educational philosophy do we have? Do we do Montessori? Do we do progressive education? It would be what's even the goal of education? Is it to train people to be good workers? Is it to train them to be good thinkers and deep valuers, to train them to be good citizens? It would be different hours, different classroom sizes, different ways of promoting and judging and evaluating teachers and students, different approaches to religion in the classroom. I mean, there'd be all sorts of these choices that are kind of stolen away from us. And precisely because there isn't a market, there isn't any competition, the problems that are in the government schools, there's no reason to think that they would change because there's absolutely no incentive to change.
Yeah, and that's a great point you brought up about test scores. You know, that doesn't capture everything. And if we had more options for people to follow the type of schooling that worked best for them, where they could really put their talents and interests to use, we wouldn't need to rely on just these standard, you know, international test comparisons, because people would be able to, you know, if someone, like I have a few friends who struggled in high school and now they're doing great working, you know, like managing construction companies, working on farms, things like that. They just didn't fit into the traditional school mold, and they were kind of forced into that, where then what they were good at was kind of viewed in a different way. So if we had more school options, which current public schools, and even to an extent charters, haven't gone far enough, though they have helped the problem, you know, it is creating a one-size-fits-all system.
Now, let's turn to college for a second. So I think most people would say that today college is more expensive than ever and yet more crucial than ever for many, many jobs in the economy. Certainly jobs that have a lot of upward mobility associated with them. And so they say that clearly the government needs to do more to help people afford college. You have some research that challenges that thinking. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, if we look at the current system of federal student loans, how it's set up is really just all to create incentives for middle-class kids to go to the most expensive school they can. And what I mean by that is the same federal student loan rate is going to apply to everyone, regardless of what major you're picking, what school you're picking, your past academic success, your work experience. All of these things are ignored in a, you know, kind of just straight universal interest rate. And that may be fine, but one major problem with how the system's set up now is it's also a sort of a blank check to colleges to just increase their tuition. Even the U.S. Treasury found that for every dollar in increased federal-based aid, scholarships went down a dollar. So schools are realizing they can transfer the burden from students to then taxpayers. And also they can just keep increasing costs because, like, let's say someone who really shouldn't have, you know, went to college, they weren't ready yet, they didn't know what they wanted to study, and $40,000 a year for a four-year private school probably wasn't the best choice for them. Well, even if they, let's say, fail out, there's no skin off the college's back. The next year, they can just bring in another misled freshman and keep getting these federally funded tuition dollars. And I do see one area where we need to assign some blame is in high school guidance counselors. They're pushing everyone to go for a four-year, you know, BA degree or go in for even like STEM majors or things like that. You're pushing everyone into four-year schools without taking into account that maybe they're not ready for that, that doesn't fit their skills. And also, you know, they're not going to be held accountable later. Colleges, if their graduates can't find employment, or the bigger problem that they can't find employment that you actually needed to go to college for, they're not losing from the system. So they just keep playing in it. And that's why we've seen college tuition shoot up so much and, you know, now stand at over $1 trillion in outstanding student loans.
One of the things that reminds me of is commentators used to, particularly immigrants to this country, would reflect on the difference between kind of how the Europeans operated and how Americans operated, and that in Europe it was the idea of you rise in effect through bureaucracy, that the ideal is there's steps laid out and you know you take your bureaucrat test and then eventually you'll rise through the ranks and so on, and that in America the focus was completely different. It was being the architect of your own future. It was, I have a certain goal and I'm going to figure out how to pursue and achieve it. And that took many different forms and there was no clear-cut path. And I think we've kind of fallen into this idea of it's not exactly through the government bureaucracy anymore, but there's this kind of path that everyone should follow to this blanket view of what success consists of. And it's you go to high school, then you go to college, and then ideally you go to a really good college, and then, you know, you become a consultant or, you know, one of these handful of allegedly successful careers. And precisely in that that is not everybody's able or interested in doing that means that you get this kind of false alternative between, well, you take a, you know, job at Starbucks or you go through this kind of laid out process. And one of the things that happens then is that many kind of successful, fulfilling, challenging jobs that are of, let's say, the blue collar variety, whether it's being an electrician or a plumber or any of the things you would have seen on the Dirty Jobs show, those get dismissed, and kids who would have been able to pursue that kind of goal get pushed, whether by parents or guidance counselors or whomever, into pursuing this path where they don't make it through and end up in Starbucks or somewhere else.
Yeah. And, you know, these are people who could find success doing something else like a trade school or even just getting an associate's degree at a 2-year college. That opens up a lot of doors for you. And if you get in a high return field, you know, let's talk about healthcare or IT, you can actually your earnings afterwards based on, you know, how much you need to pay in and the time you miss working, it can easily exceed what happens if you go to a 4-year school and are among the, it's only 40% of people graduate within 4 years at college now. And I think it's close to, it's over 50% of recent college graduates are either unemployed or underemployed, which means you're working in a job that you didn't need to go to college for. So really, what are you spending all this money and time on? And, you know, if you're going to treat it as just a 4-year vacation, that's fine. But then it's consumption. It's not investment. And I don't think it's fair for government policy to subsidize, you know, middle class kids' consumption of partying when money, you know, could be returned back to people or even, you know, go to another cause besides that. So the college, our current system, we're subsidizing consumption, but we kind of lie to ourselves and say, you know, oh, this is an investment in human capital. And in a lot of cases it is, but that's not how it works for everyone.
I'm curious if you know offhand, I've heard different claims about how much debt the average college student actually ends up with. On the low end, I've heard that actually, given the scholarships and so on that do exist, it's usually, I think, even under $10,000, and that the problem is much exaggerated. But I'm curious if you know the answer to that.
Yeah, for recent graduates, for the class of 2014, so last year, it was $27,000 was the average debt at graduation, and that's from the New York Federal Reserve. They track this and release it every few years, do a big report on college debt. So saying it's under $10,000, I'm not sure what measure they could be using. I mean, I did see slightly different things, but I would say it's definitely between like 25 and 35. That's if you want to get an accurate picture, that's where we're looking at. But this debt, you know, it's not, you can't shed it in bankruptcy for federal student loans, which I guess, you know, if taxpayers are paying for it, that does make sense. But this is debt that's going to burden you for the rest of your life. Some of the millennials we talked to, one of them, she had over $70,000 in debt because she went to a four-year private school. But she knows she needs to go back to school to get where she wants to be in her career. But she said right now she really can't afford it. So it's like, you know, because of what I majored in, you know, politics, I need to get a graduate degree to become really employable besides like kind of entry level things. So she feels like she needs to go back to school, but also that she can't go back to school when nearly $1,000 a month is going to her student loans. So it does create a kind of quality of life difference between people who either, you know, make smarter decisions and go to schools that they can afford or ones who are able to get scholarships versus other people who are brought into this system, you know, telling them they've got to go to this college, you've got to go to the best one you get into. And price tag is also viewed as in the rankings of colleges, they look at the price and tie that in. So that's kind of an odd incentive there, but it definitely creates a major burden that graduates will carry for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I always tell students is when I speak to them is that, like, that is nonsense. That I have just a bachelor's degree in business from, like, a step above or below, depending on how you'd rank it, the University of Phoenix. But it was, I dedicated myself to doing something that I was really passionate about. Now, for some fields, you know, if you want to work in, you know, the highest ranks of, you know, some political thing or some certain organizations, then maybe that can make a difference. But that this idea that you have no hope unless you go into $100,000 debt, I think is just wrong. And as you're pointing out, the consequence of that is it really, although it opens certain doors, having that much debt closes a lot of doors and really constrains the opportunities that are available to you. Because a lot of success is achieved by people in their 20s taking big risks, and you're not really in a position to do that if you have $1,000 a month that has to go to pay your debt, and you know you're just stuck with that.
Yeah, and going back to what you said about kind of, you know, checking the boxes for your career and just going through the steps, that is the view a lot of people are taking on this. And, you know, they're like, I don't know what I want to do, so therefore I'm going to go to law school and go further into debt. Like, but the business community still wants to see success. They want to see if you've got proven success working in a company. They really don't care where you went to school. Like what I always tell students is the only time you'll have to put your GPA on an application is your first job out of college. After that, no one cares anymore. It's all what you did in the workplace. But we don't have enough guidance counselors pushing this. And even if we look at a lot of people in the media, you know, it's like if you, they almost view as if you didn't go to college or don't get a secondary degree, it's like they're seeing it as a different level of success. And I think I don't have the solution for that one. I don't know how to change the culture on that, but it definitely does feed into the system.
I think one of the most interesting parts of your book is where you talk about the restrictions in the job market, the restrictions on opportunity. This is in part three of your book, Regulations That Cripple the Young. So let's say that, you know, I'm a young person getting started in life and I want to get that first job to, you know, start building skills, experience, and success. What kind of barriers am I facing?
Well, the most obvious barrier, I would say that people, you know, it's on their radar is the minimum wage. And a lot's been said about it and, you know, a lot of debate over what effect it has, how big the effect is. But I still have not been able to find anyone who supports raising the minimum wage who can then argue that the negative effects, you know, if there are any, aren't going to come on young people more. I mean, that's something you have to buy in. When I got my first job washing dishes at a Thai restaurant, like, I wasn't even worth $7.25 an hour, you know, the minimum wage, what it is now. So who knows if I would have even gotten that job. But once you can get your foot in the door, you can start working your way up. So, and, you know, people will also bring up, well, the federal government, they have something for teenagers where they can be hired for a brief period and you can try them out at a lower wage. Well, that's true, but states who raised the minimum wage on their own, which is the majority of states, most of them forgot to put in a provision in raising the wage for a teenage lower minimum wage. So when people are saying, well, there is something in place for this, well, maybe in some states, but in a lot of states, it's really expensive to hire teenagers. And we've seen teenage labor force drop off drastically. And it, the other thing I've heard back when talking about this is people say, well, you know, there's more people in school, so that's why less are participating in the labor force. But when you look at the numbers between 16 and 24, you know, when you'll be in high school and college, that's barely budged over the last decade, yet labor force participation by that group has absolutely plummeted. So there's something going on where young people are now not viewing getting into the workforce young and, you know, getting their first job as something they need to do.
One of the points you made that I think is really helpful is comparing and contrasting unemployment rates among young people in different countries. So, you know, what would, given our relatively lower minimum wage that's say than Europe, how's unemployment among young people? Can you sketch out a little bit what that data looks like?
Yeah. So as much as I have a problem with what the U.S. is doing with their labor market, for young people, it could be a lot worse. If we're looking in Europe, countries almost top 50% when they're looking at their youth unemployment. I don't even know how a country like Spain or Greece is going to get out of what they're in right now when half of their young people can't even find work. These are the ones who are looking for work too. So as bad as the U.S. is, Europe has far stronger labor market regulation, you know, worker protection, where it's pretty much impossible to hire someone or fire someone once you hire them, which again makes you much less likely to take a chance on a young person when you could hire someone at, you know, already the higher minimum wage and look at their past career. So while the minimum wage, you know, it could raise, I mean, it will raise paychecks for some people, it's also, there's a trade-off that a lot of people ignore, and that's you're going to cut off opportunity for younger workers.
Yeah, and I would even hesitate to put it as a trade-off exactly, because that starts asking these kind of central planning questions like, is it worth it to us that we increase unemployment for some and raise pay for others? Whereas the question is, do you even have the right to make that decision? Do you have the right to stop a young person from, you know, taking that first step on the ladder to success because you want to prop up wages for somebody else? And I think that's exactly one of the things that has to be challenged. I mean, you mentioned your first job. I had the similar thing. My first job was for $5.15, taking tickets at a movie theater, and I took that job because I regarded that money as worth it, given my other alternatives. And if somebody had stopped me, and then I couldn't make anything, to say that either, oh, well, you're better off because you're not being exploited, or it's okay that you're not better off because we made somebody else a little bit more wealthy, I think there's something really perverse about that idea.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons Diana and I wrote the book is, you know, the economic data is all out there. Young people are being disadvantaged by the current government policies. But yet, why hasn't something happened? I mean, one of the clear answers is that there's no really American Association of Young People who can heavily lobby Congress like there is with AARP. But the other answer is just, you know, this needs to be viewed as really a moral issue. You're not only subjecting people who never voted on any of these programs to then paying off the debt, but you're keeping them out of the workforce and you're stopping them from getting an education that really would help them succeed in their career. So this is a profoundly moral issue. And I think when you can frame it in that way and back it up with some of the points like you just said, you know, who's really got the right to tell a 16-year-old that he can't go work? You know, if he wants to be, let's say, an auto mechanic, and he really just wants to learn some tools of the trade, try to figure out what if this is something he wants to pursue. How can some government bureaucrat come in and say, you know what, no, you can't do that because we've decided that the trade-off of giving some people a higher wage is worth keeping you unemployed?
Yeah, and part of what's astonishing to this is that to me about this is that often the view on the left is that, look, we're trying to create a country where if you work, you can, you know, support yourself, and that's true dignity. And apparently, there's no dignity problem with, well, if you can't work, we'll just put you on welfare. Like the view is that you kind of are entitled to this higher paying job, or you're entitled to unearned money from other people, but they're dismissive of the notion that, look, I'm going to take advantage of whatever opportunities are open to me, whether you like them or not, and then use that as a chance to rise.
Yeah. And one thing we do see with that tying into, minimum wage was one of the chapters in the labor market regulation. The other chapter was on occupational licensing, which is pretty much the easy way to explain it is you have to get the government's permission to work. And to do that, a lot of times you have to pay a lot of money and work, spend a long time getting what they deem to be necessary training.
Can you give us an example of that or two?
So an easy example that everyone thinks of is, you know, doctors. They are licensed. Most people, you know, I guess will accept that there's some need, the debate over if it's gone too far. That's one thing to have. But what we've seen is occupational licensing has moved from things like doctors, lawyers, accountants, to now almost 4 in 10 American workers are going to need to get a government permission slip to work at some point in their life. And this is everything from florists to interior designers, tree trimmers, manicurists, all these things that takes a really big stretch of the imagination to imagine how a bad interior design could somehow put the public at risk. And that's what the regulators and lawmakers, what they do is they hide behind, you know, they say we need to do this to keep the public safe. And that's why we need to make these requirements for entering certain occupations. But like I said, it's gone far beyond that now. And it's almost comical when they're arguing that a florist could somehow endanger the public.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the view is of human nature and of the human mind. And the people who come from the perspective of collectivism and who support these kinds of restrictions have the view of, well, we're incapable of making rational decisions, and so we need the experts to look out for us. But the fact is that not only are we able to make rational decisions, we have to. I mean, the fact is, I don't care if the government tells me that this restaurant has been, quote, licensed. I'm going to look at its Yelp rating and find out, are they actually serving quality food, or are there rats swimming in the soup?
Yeah, and as bringing up Yelp is the perfect example. Like a lot of people, like let's say if there even ever was a justification for licensing florists or, you know, restaurant owners, that's really gone away now. It's so simple to find out for yourself rather than, you know, through some bureaucrat checking boxes if somewhere is, if you want to trust that place, if you want to go there, and word of mouth is more powerful than ever before. Consumers have They've always had all the power in, where they want to spend their dollars, but now they have information on their side and they, you know more about the businesses than they ever have before. And if we're also looking at occupational licensing, one thing that you see though is it's not just politicians trying to keep people safe. They're trying to keep people out of the workforce, because if we look at specific occupations, like let's go to, back to interior design, because that's actually the hardest occupation to start working in out of over 100 occupations that the Institute for Justice, this nonprofit that fights to protect people's right to work, what they looked at. So it takes over $300 and almost 6 years to become an interior designer. That makes no sense when things like if you want to be an EMT or a bus driver or any a nurse, any of these other things, you could do it so much quicker and with less cost to you. So it's pretty clear that existing interior designers, they don't want new competition coming in. So they'll use the government to do their dirty work to keep out new workers.
Yeah, and this is Ayn Rand has a lot of interesting things to say in this phenomenon. I think in her essay, The Pool Peddlers, talks about once the government has the right to regulate in the name of the public interest, there's no objective way to interpret that or define it. And so what happens is that you have all of these opportunities for people to basically say, well, the public interest is that we bar new entrants into design, and, you know, in parentheses, that protects my status in this industry, seeing as though I'm already established, and keeps out outsiders and newcomers. And so I think one error that people usually make is to think, well, if only we should get rid of the unreasonable ones like interior design, but this overall phenomenon of dictating to people who's allowed to work in what fields is okay. But I think it's precisely because who you harm is the innovator, the outsider, the newcomer, whenever somebody's allowed to arbitrarily restrict who can do what job. And for an example, what happened in the days before Yelp, or long when there was much less of this regulation, it's true that it was harder to find out whether or not, you know, a business was reliable or a person had the skills that he claimed to have. But what that did is it put a much, much greater emphasis on your credibility and on your track record. And so people viewed with much more skepticism, you know, a new business and a newcomer. And so it forced people to really work very hard to establish a reliable, credible track record. And that starts to disintegrate once you have this idea of, well, the government's making sure that my interior designer and my plumber and everybody else is doing a good job.
Yeah. And when you have, you know, government licensing like it is right now, it's really just yes or no. You know, are you licensed or are you not? When really we should have a wider spectrum. Like, for example, you know, I keep my hair short. I really don't care. I just want a cheap haircut in somewhere that's right by me. But in DC, you can't find a haircut for like under $25 for a men's cut. So it takes so long to get in and create a business that there's then not only do consumers, not young people don't have the option to go into careers, but they're also going to be paying more for the people, you know, who were lucky enough to get in. And you brought up, you know, that the entire idea of licensing, like it is definitely a slippery slope. You know, once we start saying we need to license doctors, someone else will use public good for something else. And it really does never end. The way I looked at it, though, was let's just take down the low-hanging fruit first, things that are just comical. I mean, when the pass rate for the Louisiana bar exam to become a lawyer is higher than the pass rate for the Louisiana florist exam, that's really when you know something's wrong. And it, the current, I guess, landscape of occupational licensing has become such a joke. And as you said, when the public good's brought in, it really even goes over the Constitution. If we're looking at tour guides, the government makes them be licensed in a lot of cities, including ones with a lot of colleges like New Orleans and Charleston. So, you know, to walk and talk at the same time, they're now saying you have to go through the government to be able to do that and get some money while you do it. So if a college student, you know, on the weekend, who's maybe a history major down in Charleston, wants to show around some tourists, nope, they can't do that if they don't go through, you know, months of training and pay the government fees.
So the phrase that kind of echoed through my mind as I was reading your book was the idea of the self-made man. And it was the idea that, look, you have to build the kind of life that you want for yourself. You have to acquire the skills that are going to allow you to achieve your goals. And then you have to pursue those goals and use, you know, all the resources at your disposal to do so. And that it's precisely all of these things, what they're really doing is they're really attacks on a person's ability to make something of himself from the beginning by robbing him of a quality education, all the way to when he's starting to try to get his first job, all the way to when he's trying to save and build for his future and his goals and a family if he wants to start that. And that I think what's important is to highlight how bad the assault is on somebody trying to do that. But then it leaves open the question, what is the solution? There's a lot of these bad things going on, but then how do we fight them so that we can actually get back to being free to make something of ourselves?
Yeah. And the reason I took that tone in the book is one of the reasons that I was also inspired to write it was Rolling Stone had an article. It was maybe a year and a half ago on, you know, how to help millennials. And they went through pretty much every topic I cover, but then their answer was just provide millennials with more things, just give them, you know, more free healthcare, give them free college for everyone all the time. If you want a job, that's great. You are guaranteed a job. If you don't want to work, you're guaranteed a base income. It was just absolutely terrifying to me. And people on the, you know, who are pushing for more government have written about this issue, you know, young people, and they're saying, well, we just need to forgive student loans, or we need to make college free. We need to, you know, expand entitlement programs rather than trim back what we have. So I wanted to write this book to bring kind of the side showing how government and action, even when it's well-intentioned, it does have this general tendency to harm young people. So my main solution is just we have to go through government regulations, and if we, you know, let's just say we can't get rid of all of them right now, they need to be viewed through the eyes of how they affect new entrants to the workforce. Because that's who we should be focusing on, if anyone. Like, you're, when you're limiting opportunity from someone and not taking that into account when evaluating a regulation, that's a major problem. So I see regulatory reform as the first way we're going to get out of that. And also just greater political engagement, because, you know, elected officials aren't going to do anything until everyone, not just young people, realizes this is a problem. When all of a sudden grandparents are going to the polls and keeping in mind, like, well, this person's policies are really putting, you know, my grandkids and their grandkids in a terrible position, I'm not going to vote for that. Until we get to that point, the general tendency of government to keep growing and keep getting further into our lives, taking away opportunity, is going to continue.
Yeah, I mean, the Rolling Stone article is, I mean, it's the perfect distillation of the philosophy, which instead of the self-made man, they want the state-made man. But what that really means in the end is crushing the self-made man, because it's who are the victims? It's precisely the people who would make something of themselves if they had that chance to get that first job, in order to reward people who, well, I don't want to have to pay for college. I want somebody else to pay for it. I don't want to have to think about how to save for my future. I want somebody else to do that. And so I think it's really important to draw attention to these issues. And I definitely agree with you. It's not, it shouldn't be looked through the lens of generational warfare. What it really is warfare on the on those who want to make something of their lives, and by people who don't want to be bothered to have to do that, and or more broadly, who think that no, nobody should have to do that. You should just be basically guaranteed everything in life. And who does that fall on? Yeah, it largely falls under the young people just getting started. And I think there's a real tragedy to that, but also an opportunity, because it's precisely young people who are open to new ideas. And if they're presented with a problem and a clear, inspiring, aspirational solution, I think can change things.
Yeah, and if we look at, you know, where young people have seen the most success in the tech sector, you know, their skills are valued there. They're finding high paid jobs. They're moving up really quickly. I mean, they're, you know, starting companies and becoming millionaires and billionaires in their 20s. Like, but that's the most unregulated sector of the economy, at least currently. The government's doing its best to try to make that like interior design. But I think it does show that young people aren't any less deserving of success. They're not less talented. They're not, you know, just dumber. Like there's things that people throw around all the time when talking about millennials. But I think the tech sector shows the promise of if we would just move it up more so that people could make themselves and kind of build their careers rather than having to play in a system that works against them.
My guest today has been Jared Meyer. Jared, thank you for being part of the Debt Dialogues.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So no wrap-up of the show itself today, but as you may have noticed, we have been very infrequent in irregular in publishing episodes of the Debt Dialogues, probably for the last few months. And as I mentioned on previous shows, the main reason for that was that I was feverishly trying to wrap up work on my book with Yaron Brook on inequality. I'm happy to say that that book's done. And after an extended leave so that I could welcome my second child into the world. I'm back, and we should be ready to go back at our regularly scheduled weekly pace. With that, it's time to bring this podcast to a close. If you enjoy it, please take a minute to give us a review on iTunes. To learn more, you can visit endthedebtdraft.com. And for the latest, I encourage you to like our Facebook page, facebook.com/debtdraft, and let the world know that it's time to put an end to entitlement exploitation. See you next time.
Debt Dialogues is property of the Ayn Rand Institute. Its content is intended for private use only.